It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Are we alone in the universe? Now, that's a question we humans have asked ourselves for thousands of years. It's also one of the questions at the heart of a talk to be given next week at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Sean Domagal-Goldman is a research space scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. And next Wednesday, he'll be giving a presentation titled "The Scientific Search for Life on Planets Near and Far." And that will be next Wednesday, February 25th at 7 p.m. He joins us now to give us a little preview of what his talk is about and the research he's doing. Sean, welcome to our program.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to my visit to Iowa next week.
Listeners to this program over the past few months have been kept up to date on the incredible news from NASA's Kepler mission, a space telescope launched back in 2009 that's been looking for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way. So far, hundreds of Earth-like planets discovered. Tell us, what is the focus of your research?
Well, so my research is about what happens next. We now have found all these wonderful planets through the Kepler mission, and we should also give credit to our colleagues that do planet searches with ground-based observatories in Hawaii and across the world. But the question is, now that we're finding all these planets, how do we find out what they're like? What are their chemical compositions? Do they have life? And what kind of life might they have? We're sort of just starting to think about what experiments we want to do next in the form of the next suite of space-based telescopes that could probe these planets further to answer those questions.
Okay, so define for us the Kepler mission, which has made these marvelous discoveries. What are the limits of what it is? How is it defining what is an Earth-like planet or probable and potentially an Earth-like planet? What does it have to go on?
Well, so Kepler really just looks at the physics and the astronomy of these planets. That's the kind of the way that I internalize it. Kepler is just staring at a patch of the sky about the size of your hand outstretched. It stares at all the stars in that field of sky, and every once in a while, if a planet passes between that star and us, and therefore between that, it would also pass between that star and the Kepler telescope, that star gets a little bit dimmer because the planet is blocking that star's light. And so by observing that star a bunch of times, if it sees two or three or hopefully four or five transits of that planet, that's called a transit event, by the way, so if I use that lingo, that's what it means. Mm-hmm. If that happens a number of times, then astronomers will say, well, there's a planet there. But that information, really, all it gives us is by how much the star dims, we can tell the radius of the planet, in other words, how big the planet is on the sky, because the bigger planets will block more starlight and cause a bigger dimming event. And based on how often that transit happens, we can determine what the length of the orbit is. And if you go back into actually Kepler's laws of motion for planets, you can then figure out how far away from the star the planet is. And you add all that information, and you start to put together secondary information on how much energy the planet receives from the star. And that's what is really interest to us, that are those of us that are thinking about habitability and the search for life, because we have a Goldilocks zone. You can be too hot or too close to your parent star and therefore become too hot. You can be too far away from your parent star and therefore be too cold. Or you can be where Earth is. You can be right in the middle, just right in the Goldilocks zone. So we're looking for the planets that are in that Goldilocks zone. And we're also looking for planets that aren't too big or too small. If a planet's too small, it could end up like Mars and have a very thin atmosphere, or like the Moon and have no atmosphere at all. If it's too big, it could end up like one of our gas giants and have a massive atmosphere that would make life unlikely. And frankly, if there was life on a planet with a massive atmosphere, I don't know how we'd see through that massive atmosphere to find the life. And so we look for planets that are not too big, not too small, not too hot, not too cold. And, mm-hmm. and the ones that aren't any of those things are the ones that we consider to be habitable. But it's basically just the size of the planet and how much energy it gets from its parent star. We get some other information, but that's really the majority of the stuff that we're getting now.
Where's your data coming from, though?
Well, I'm a modeler, the joke is I make my data up. What I do is I run computer simulations of the next generation of missions would look for, and the next generation of missions is going to look at the colors of these planets. And so to think about what the colors might be like, you have to guess basically, or simulate what their surfaces would be like. You have to simulate what their atmosphere compositions, what gases are in their atmosphere. You have to simulate whether or not their atmospheres would have clouds and hazes like you would have on a really traffic-filled day. You don't really have many of those in Iowa, but we have them in D.C., or if you go up to Chicago, you'd have some. So if you have have like those types of simulations, you can start to build a picture of what colors that planet might have. And those are the sort of simulations that we do, and we try to make them as imaginative as possible without breaking the laws of physics and chemistry and geology and astronomy, because we're trying as best we can to anticipate the unexpected. And I will say, one of the things that has been a pleasure as a modeler is to watch all of these things that the modelers did not predict become things that we observe quite often in the universe. And so I'm trying to take a lesson from from that history, and we're trying to simulate the unexpected simulate what we wouldn't necessarily expect as much as we can. Right. You know, we base our models on Earth and the other planets in the solar system and the history of those worlds, but we try to bend that as much as we can without breaking the laws that we're aware of.
Yeah, it was not too long ago that Kepler discovered an ancient solar system that was far, far older than we ever imagined.
That's right. We have found ancient solar systems. We found some of the very first planets we found were called hot Jupiters. These are planets the size of the gas giants, which all the gas giants are in the outer parts of our solar system. Well, in other planetary systems, those gas giants can be closer to their parent star than our closest planet, Mercury, is to the sun. In other words, the big stuff that we thought had to form far outside in the outer reaches of the systems were occurring close to their star. That means that either planets have to move around over time, which we didn't really think was possible, or it means the gas giants form close to their stars, which we didn't think was possible. And another example, actually my favorite example of the unexpected discoveries, is something that was predicted but not by the scientists. One of my earliest memories is of watching Star Wars and watching Luke Skywalker view this beautiful double sunset on Tatooine as he ponders his fate. Am I going to join the rebellion, right? It's this beautiful artistic scene.
Mm-hmm.
And all the astrophysicists, of course, said, well, that's nice artistry, but George, it's impossible. You would never get a planet orbiting a double star system like that. Well, sure enough, Kepler comes along 30 years later, and what has it found? A number of planets that orbit double stars in a way that would give you a sunset like that. Now, I should point out, none of those specific planets have been found to be in the habitable zone, but those are possible, and we thought they were impossible before. And it just goes to show how we have to stretch our expectations as much as we can when we're trying to simulate what we're going to discover in 20 or 30 years.
So
that's the challenge.
So you and your colleague at the Goddard Space Flight Center in this similar research, you're doing a lot of sort of what-ifs, and you're saying, I want to stretch my imagination. Give me an example of what conversations you would have with colleagues. What if what?
Well, so my nightmare scenario, the thing that keeps me awake at night, is we build this telescope, we spend considerable taxpayer dollars to do so, we launch it, it works exactly as we plan it to work, we find a planet that has the signatures, which we can talk about in a little bit, that would indicate that planet has life, we pop the champagne, we get on the phone with the president, we tell him or her that we found evidence of life beyond Earth, they call a press conference the next day, we announce it to our colleagues, and a week later we have egg on our faces because we didn't detect life, we just found some atmospheric chemistry that we didn't anticipate that someone else knew about and we weren't quite incorporating into our models yet. That's the nightmare scenario. And so a lot of our conversations are about what are the ways that nature could trick us? What are the ways that a planet could make a signal that looks like life, even if there's not life on the planet? And what are the ways that we could discriminate between these? I call these false positives, things that aren't life-bearing worlds but would look like that based on our search strategy. What are the things we can do on the mission to discriminate between the true positives that are life-bearing worlds and the false positives that just appear like they are life-bearing? And what does that mean for the instrumentation of that mission? What does that mean for what wavelengths, what colors that mission needs to observe, and how big the telescope needs to be? We want to answer those questions now, because if we get to that place, 20, 30 years from now, where that mission's operating, we think we found life, I want to have that secondary strategy to rule out the tricky cases.
Sean Damagald-Goldman is my guest, if you've just joined us. He's a research space scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. He'll be in Iowa next week to deliver a presentation titled The Scientific Search for Life on Planets Near and Far. If you're looking for life outside of our solar system, or even within our solar system, how much do you study the way life developed here on Earth?
So we study it a lot, and I'll give you two examples. If you got in a time machine and went back 2.5 billion years, pick your favorite time machine from H.G. Wells. For me, it was the DeLorean from Back to the Future. Get in that time machine, go back 2.5 billion years. If you don't bring an oxygen tank with you, you would suffocate. And that's not because the planet didn't have an atmosphere at the time. It's because the atmosphere at the time had no oxygen, and that's the gas that we breathe. And it didn't have any oxygen, yet it had life. So this is a weird – I call this the most alien biosphere for which we have data. And in this case, the data don't come from a telescope. It comes from the rocks. So geologists go. They look at the rocks that tell us all about Earth history. They tell me what the environment was like at the time. Geobiologists will look at the same rocks and tell me that life was present at the time. And I put all that into my models and recreate a story that can reproduce all the data from the geologists and the geochemists and the geobiologists. And those have led to us to thinking about some of the weird things we might look for beyond Earth. One thing that we plan to look for are stinky sulfur gases. These are the things that if you buy a fish at a market, take it home and leave it. I don't recommend this. This is definitely a do not do at home unless you are willing to enter into divorce proceedings experiment. Get a fish, take it home, put it on your counter, and leave it there for a couple days. And what you smell a couple days later are the same gases that we might look for on other planets when we're looking for the weird types of life that lived very, very early on in Earth's history. Again, that's a do not do at home, but that gives you an idea of some of the weird things.
So you mentioned this next stage involves the signatures for life. Would the stinky sulfur gases be a signature for life?
Yeah, and they would, but the reason I say they're weird is these are gases that they're made on modern day Earth, but they don't last very long. They get destroyed by the oxygen that's in our atmosphere. But the case that I'm worried about is this very early period of Earth's history. We want to look for oxygen. That's the main biosignature that we're looking for, the gas that we're breathing. It's made by plants and made by bacteria in the oceans. But if you think about what I said, if you go back in deep enough in Earth history, there's a period where the oxygen wasn't around, but life was around. This is actually a third of the history of life on Earth. And so we're worried about, I mentioned false positives. This would be a false negative. We'd look for oxygen, we wouldn't find it, and we'd say, okay, that planet's dead, and move on. Well, it turns out that these smelly sulfur gases that are made on modern-day Earth but don't stick around on modern-day Earth, they would have stuck around on this ancient planet. And the reason is the oxygen that is present today but was gone back then is the thing that destroys those gases. So it's the absence of the oxygen is what would have allowed those gases to accumulate to high enough levels where we would be able to detect them with a telescope from far away. And so Earth is absolutely a guide.
Okay. So if I'm getting your drift, Kepler, for instance, has identified hundreds of Earth-like planets, and your job is to look at the next generation, to model planets further in their chemistry, to figure out the chemical composition that would be likely there for life or could be in the development of a planet. And where does it go from there?
Well, so that's sort of the progression. We go from physics, which is what we're getting now, the physics and astronomy, then we go through the chemistry. And to me, it's the interpretation of the chemistry that leads to whether or not a planet has life. One example I give is, how would I know whether or not pizza has been delivered to a college campus recently? Well, if I went onto that college campus and I saw a bunch of students in a room and I saw pizza was in that room, I would have a good idea that the pizza was recently delivered to that room. Because, as we all know, college students not only eat pizza, but they eat pizza quite rapidly. And so that tells me that the pizza was recently delivered, and that tells me that a pizza delivery person is somewhere in the area. Likewise, when we're looking for the stuff that life makes, we look for gases in an atmosphere that are produced by life. And if we find them in an atmosphere in which they're rapidly destroyed, that would tell us that those gases were recently and rapidly created. And there are some gases that can only be rapidly created by biology, and those are the gases that we're looking for. And the specific example is the oxygen gas that we breathe. If you find that in an atmosphere that has other gases like methane, which acts to destroy oxygen, you know that the oxygen was recently and rapidly delivered to that atmosphere. And so in the analogy, the pizza is the oxygen, the college students are the methane, and life is the pizza delivery person that's bringing the oxygen to the party.
What is your view on life in the universe, knowing what you do, which is a considerable amount, as we're hearing in this half hour?
To answer your question, yeah, I think it's out there. But the cool thing isn't that I think it's out there. The cool thing is that I think is out there is something we can test with the rigors of the scientific method. We can turn that pondering into a hypothesis that we can test with experiments. And that, to me, is what's special about the moment that we're living in right now.
Sean, how old of a guy are you?
I'm 35 years old.
Sound like a young guy. Will it happen in your lifetime?
To me, I think, you know, it depends on which target you're talking about, whether it's Mars or Europa. If we talk about the extrasolar planets, my guess is sometime in the late 2020s or in the early 2030s, we, being the United States and NASA, are going to lead an international effort to launch a telescope that would be able to do this. That's my hope. We're planning a mission that's going to not only be able to look for life, but be able to estimate how common it is in the universe to within 10% to estimate how common it is on the potentially habitable worlds to within a factor of 10%.
Sean, we always hear this phrase, life as we know it. Will it necessarily be life like we know it, or are you also looking for life as we don't know it?
Well, we always start with life as we know it. We do that because it's easiest to look for the things you know best. You know, if you told me you lost your keys and you wanted help finding them, the first thing I would do is I would tell you to look for all the places that I lose my keys. That's how we start. But that's not to say that that's where we should finish. This is one of the reasons that I mentioned earlier. This is why we look in Earth history. If we look at the weird things that Earth has shown us in the rock record of our planet's history, that'll teach us lessons about the weird things that might be out there. That's stepping a little bit outside the box. When we look at the other planets in our solar system, Mars, Europa, Titan, Venus, and we look at their histories, that's also another way to step outside the box. Get data on those planets, validate our models against those worlds, and then see the ways we can combine the different solar system worlds and their different parts of their histories in unique ways, ways that didn't happen on any one planet. But when we think about, what happened to Mars a long time ago happened to Earth a long time ago. We can start playing those games and start putting things together.
Do you ever look to Hollywood for creative models, or are they pretty conservative when it comes to imagining things that might be elsewhere in the universe?
I do. I'm an avid sci-fi movie watcher. I'm an avid sci-fi book reader. And a lot of times that stuff gets dismissed, but, you know, it's kind of neat when the sci-fi visionaries end up being right. And I think about that stuff a lot, both because it's fun, but also because sometimes thinking a little bit outside the box, outside the confines of the models that I derive can be useful.
You're looking for life outside of our planet, perhaps outside of our solar system with your modeling. But I was looking at a survey from 2012 for National Geographic, finding that extraterrestrial visits to Earth is not that crazy of an idea to most Americans. About a third of Americans think that aliens have visited Earth. About 80% believe that the government has kept information about UFOs secret from the public. How do you react to such beliefs?
Well, so, you know, anyone's entitled to their beliefs, but what I stress is this is something that's very hard for me to test with the scientific method. It's hard for me when it's a story of something happening to somebody at a specific time in the past where I can't predict where it's going to happen again. If I could predict where that sort of thing would happen again, great, let's go. We could bring cameras. We could bring your tape recording equipment, and you could do an interview with the aliens that are coming to Earth. But when it's this idea of something that's being covered up, when it's this idea of it's something that's been hidden from view intentionally, whether it's from our government or whether it's from the aliens hiding in plain sight, so to speak, there's just no way to test that with a scientific method. So, again, that's fine for barroom conversations, but that doesn't enter into our conversations because it's not something that we can test as a hypothesis with a scientific method. So, you know, I'm not surprised by it that, you know, I see this stuff all the time. It's influenced by the stuff in Hollywood, but it's separate from the stuff we discuss. Now, the one place I'll say that it overlaps is that presumes not just life being outside Earth, but it presumes intelligent life existing outside Earth. And we are just starting to think about what kinds of signals intelligent life would give off that we'd be able to detect with a telescope. Many of your listeners may have heard of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This is what was made famous by the movie Cosmos in the 90s. And by the way, that's one of the movies that really motivated me to go into the field I'm in. We're thinking of something that we think of as like a piggyback SETI effort or a piggyback SETI effort, where we could look for the things that an intelligent civilization might put in the atmosphere in pollution or in terms of climate-altering things that we could detect with our telescope that would tell us not only life is present on a planet, but that intelligent, advanced, industrialized life is present on that planet. Now, we don't count on that being successful, but we at least want to know what those signals look like before we fly the mission.
Okay. Oh, one last question, Sean, before we let you go. Let's say in your lifetime, in my lifetime, life outside our planet is found. It's confirmed 100% in terms of physics, in terms of chemistry, and then the third stage, you said, the biology is confirmed. Do you have any thoughts on how that would change thinking here on Earth, or if it would at all?
I think that would be a moment for me on a personal level of pure celebration. I would be tempted to retire after that, thinking I grew up a Chicago Bulls fan, and I'd be tempted to retire the way that Michael Jordan did the first time. You know, whether I was a part of that mission or not, I would be so ecstatic. I would just be ready to retire a happy man. In terms of how it would affect, and I'm biased, I'm obviously clearly biased, it would affect me a tremendous amount. As far as how it would affect society, I will tell you, I am torn on this. I've heard some people say that it would be the next version of the Copernican Revolution, and I think that would be wonderful if it would improve our understanding of our place in the cosmos and allow us to see ourselves as part of something much bigger. But I've also heard people say that if others don't want to believe this, if they choose not to believe it, that there's going to be plenty of reasons for them to deny our data. And I see that all the time in science, and it's a very troubling trend, whether it's on climate change or whether it's on the age of the Earth or whether it's on the need for people to get vaccinated. People that don't want to believe something have a profound ability in our brains, and this comes from us being intelligent, to come up with alternate explanations for the data that are out there. And I don't believe that we are going to have data that are so convincing that we're going to be able to convince every skeptic. So to me, I hope that it would be a new warm moment that we'd all bask in and celebrate upon. But I also do understand the reality that if people decide that they would like to deny it, that they're going to be capable of doing so. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to be sort of a mix of those two realities. You'll have some people that deny it because that makes them feel more comfortable, and you'll have others that look at the data we put out there and agree with our assessment and celebrate with us and think about our place in the cosmos when we're not as alone as we were the day before.
Sean Domagal Goldman is a research space scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and next Wednesday he'll be giving a presentation at the University of Northern Iowa entitled Scientific Search for Life on Planets Near and Far. It's been fascinating talking with you, Sean. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, tornado research. On one day in April of 2011, more than 120 tornadoes touched down in the southeastern U.S. We'll hear from two University of Iowa scientists about how they think air pollution may have helped intensify those tornadoes. That's coming up. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River.